Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the next installment of our series of the American Orthodox Rabbinate, rabbis who help transform and really laid often in many cases the foundation for the thriving, vibrant Orthodox in America, Orthodoxy in America that we enjoy today. When you walked in, what you heard was Rabbi Teitz's Hesped for Rav Moshe Feinstein, and I played it just as you came in and people were coming in to get a flavor and a taste of a personality who was relatively contemporaneous, that we could still hear his voice and feel his passion and his presence even before we get to know him this evening. Now, a few words of introduction before we begin. Number one, it's a very intimidating class or lecture to deliver because half of you in this room grew up in Elizabeth, you knew Rabbi Teitz, you served as his loyal gabbai, and I know that you knew him infinitely better than I. My goal tonight is not to deliver a comprehensive PhD-level dissertation on Rav Pinchas Teitz Zatzal, but rather, I'm not speaking to those of you who knew him, I'm speaking to those who didn't, as part of our greater series to appreciate and understand his role in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which was an anomaly at its time, which was a radical breakthrough against all odds, and to appreciate how it became a paradigm and a model that even we here in Boca Raton, and arguably more than many other communities, continue to follow until today. I feel very connected to Rabbi Teitz. When we gave out the names or the three teachers who divvied up this course, I grabbed Rabbi Teitz. Because as many of you know, my family goes back to Elizabeth actually before Rabbi Teitz. And we'll talk about that tonight. And the very, very special and close relationship that our families shared. I personally have memories, though they're as a young child, with Rabbi Teitz, and that's why it's very exciting for me to be able to have done this research and to share what I found with you this evening. And I want to acknowledge Dr. Blau, Dr. Rivka Blau, her wonderful book, which really is the authoritative work on her father, Learn Torah, Live Torah, Love Torah, Live Torah, the quintessential rabbi. She did all of the heavy lifting and the hard work. I'm grateful to her. There's an article in an art school book called Torah Leaders, which originally was a Jewish Observer article, and several other sources that also contribute. I have here a book by Miriam Stark Zakon. This is an art school book based on conversations with Rabbi Eliyahu Essas, a refusnik from Russia, and there's a whole chapter in here about Rabbi Teitz as well. So we were able to call this from several sources, but overwhelmingly, obviously, Dr. Blau's book was instrumental. So let's begin. Rabbi Teitz was born July 7th, 1908, the 8th of Tammuz in Subat, Latvia. There is a map of Latvia near Riga. You see on top his mother, Rebbetzin Shena Sira Shapiro Teitz, lived 1873 to 1955. On the bottom right is a picture of a young Reb Pinchas Teitz with his mother. Even at a young age, he towered over his mother, which was probably a confluence of his being tall and her being relatively short. But it's a lovely picture of him and his mother. His father, Binyamin Avram Teitz, 1872 to 1956, was a great Talmud Chacham, himself a Rav, in fact the 19th in a line of rabbis that went back centuries and centuries. So Rabbi Teitz, when he didn't really have much of an option of what he was going to go into, being the 20th generation after his father. His father led a very interesting shul. He was the Rav of a shul that had misnagdim in one end of the building, chassidim on the other end of the building, on one campus, and the rabbi and his family lived in that same building in between. I don't know if they were the buffer zone, no man's land, or they were actually the glue that held the both sides together in a unified community. But I share that with you both because it's fascinating, and also because with many of the great individuals we've studied, we see in their youth, their exposure within their own family, their teachers, their community, clearly shapes and influences their values, priorities, and ideals, and who ultimately they become. I'm going to do something that Rabbi Teitz never would have done, which is I'm taking off my jacket. Okay. Rabbi Binyamin Avram was really a Rabinovich, but to avoid being drafted, this is a very fascinating story, Dr. Blau goes into, we won't discuss at length, but Rabbi Teitz was not really a Teitz. His father was a Rabinovich, a Rabinovich. But there were several brothers, and there was fear of their being drafted into the army, risking their lives, losing their Judaism, and people used very creative, they used tremendous ingenuity in order to be able to escape. There was a Teitz family who had lost a son and didn't report the loss of that son to the government. And so the Rabinovitz family took that Teitz boy's papers, and Rabbi Teitz's father assumed the name Teitz, even though he wasn't really a Teitz. Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, he was known as Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, but his full name really was Rabbi Mordechai Pinchas Teitz. In fact, it was interesting, and I discussed with my good friend Rabbi Benny Blau this question. Even in a work that Rabbi Teitz himself published, on the cover page he calls himself Harav Pinchas Mordechai Teitz, and further in he's Rav Mordechai Pinchas Teitz. He was known as Rav Pinchas Teitz, and when he was called to the Torah, he was Rav Mordechai Pinchas Teitz, but he does use them interchangeably. He's named for his great-grandfather, Rav Mordechai Rabinovitz, who was a big Talmud Chacham. And the evidence of that is from whom he had smicha, the Netziv, the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yitzchak Kahanan, the giants of his generation. And to be able to flaunt smicha from those giants meant that you were qualified and competent. His middle name, Pinchas, was assumed because of the week in which he was born, Shabbos Parshas Pinchas. And Pinchas was a kanoi. Rabbi Teitz was not a kanoi, would not be an accurate description, but Pinchas was a zealot who stood up to defend the honor of Hashem. Pinchas was a zealot who had no fear, tenaciously had resolve in order to defend what he thought was right, and Rav Pinchas Teitz certainly took on that attribute from his namesake in the Parsha. He had illustrious yichus, including having descended from the Levush and the Maharshal and others. His great uncle, remember, his father wasn't really a Teitz. His father was a Rabinovitz or a Rabinovich. So his great uncle was the Aderet, the famous Rav Eliyahu David Rabinovitz, who was a twin. He had a twin, and therefore the name Te'umim was added on. He was Rabinovitz Te'umim, and therefore known as his acronym, the Aderet. If you ever heard, he was a great Talmud Chacham, the Aderet. It's a very sad story that the Aderet was a Rav in Panovich and Mir in 1901. He went to Yerushalayim to become the assistant to Rav Shmuel Salant, who was significantly his senior. Rav Salant was going to be retiring as the chief rabbi of Israel, of Yerushalayim rather, and the Aderet was assuming the position and came to be his assistant with the assumption that he would assume the position after. But the Aderet, a very short time after he got there, the Aderet passed away. And Rav Salant, who was already much his senior, lived deep into his 90s, unusual at that time. I remember once discussing with Rav Asher Weiss, the Minchas Asher, about going on Har HaBayit today, what he thought, the halachic issues, whether you should or shouldn't. And his reaction was not to share his halachic analysis, but he told me a story that when the Aderet came, they set up an apartment that overlooked Har HaBayit. And he looked out the window and he said, "You're going to give me such heartache. You're going to shorten my life that every day I'm going to look and see there's no Beis HaMikdash. Every day I'll look and see, I'll be reminded that this Churban, instead of it being a nice, spiritually uplifting, he didn't look down and see Karbach Minyanim. He didn't see soldiers dancing with Hasidim. He didn't see birthright groups. He looked and he saw desolation, abandonment, destruction." And in fact, the Aderet died a relatively young man a short time after going. When Rabbi Binyamin, Rabbi Teitz's father, was younger, he lived with that uncle, the Aderet, and his chavrusa was none other, Rabbi Teitz's father's chavrusa, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Rav Cook married the Aderet's daughter, Batsheva Alta, who tragically died only a few years later. So Rabbi Teitz, through his father, and really became mishpacha, because his great uncle's daughter, namely his cousin once removed, married Rav Cook. That marriage tragically lasted only a short time because she died young, but Rabbi Teitz was mishpacha with Rav Cook. And in fact, earlier today, when someone, perhaps related to me, was sharing his high school yearbook with me from the JEC, there was a Rav Cook award which was given out at the JEC, and perhaps now we understand the background, not necessarily a reflection of an ideological statement, as much as also an acknowledgement of the relationship. During World War I, the Teitz family were refugees in Russia. They realized that communists were making laws that would make it difficult to live as observant Jews, and it was time to leave. They returned to Latvia. Rav Pinchas, our Rabbi Teitz, celebrated his bar mitzvah on the train. That's when he turned 13. There was no logo or emblem. They didn't make new yarmulkes for him or t-shirts. It wasn't represented by sports teams or an agent. There wasn't a lavish kiddush with a carving station. It didn't even have a sefer Torah to be able to read his bar mitzvah parasha from. And so he read it from a printed chumash on the train. That was the celebration of his bar mitzvah. The family settled soon after. The community of Livanov asked Rabbi Teitz to lead their community. And though it was a Hasidish community and had four Hasidish shtiblach, Rabbi Teitz was technically a misnagid, but he had such a reputation as a Talmud Chacham, as a leader, that they invited him to come. Nonetheless, we're still talking now about Rabbi Teitz's father. He accepted and he served there until World War II. Livanov was only 40 kilometers from Dvinsk. And in Dvinsk, there were two incredible Talmidei Chachamim who lived just a short distance away. Namely, Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen and Rabbi Yosef Rosen, the Rogatchev Gaon. Rav Pinchas' father, Rabbi Teitz's father, had a close relationship with the Rogatchev, who in turn had tremendous respect for him. So much so, in fact, that when people came to Dvinsk to meet the Rogatchev and to get a bracha, he would send them instead 40 kilometers away to Rabbi Binyamin Teitz and say, go to Binyamin HaTzadik. Why are you getting a bracha from me, said the Rogatchev, who probably both believed that Rabbi Teitz was worthy or more worthy and wanted to get back to his learning. So as the strategy said, why are you coming to me? Go to Binyamin HaTzadik. Pesach 1923, he was only 14 years old. Our Rabbi Teitz Jr., I guess not relative to the Rabbi Teitz is yet today. Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, we're calling by his name, at only 14 years old, at his father's encouragement, went to Dvinsk in order to meet these giants of Torah, who were giants of that generation. Not only did he meet both of them, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk and the Rogatchev, he developed a relationship, not only a relationship, such a close relationship that he certainly benefited from their leadership and influence, but they benefited as well. Because in many ways, Rabbi Teitz is responsible for the proliferation of their Torah and our access to it even today. That's Rav Meir Simcha on the top, and that is the Rogatchev on the bottom. Rogatchev had an unusual look, and that's because he had an inability to stop thinking Torah. So he never sat in a barber's chair because he couldn't take a yarmulke off in order to get a haircut. He couldn't stop thinking about Torah, even for the time it would take to get a haircut. He had a memory, Rabbi Teitz described in his day, that the only way to appreciate the Rogatchev's memory is through the vocabulary of computers. Said Rabbi Teitz, only because we have computers today that have such extraordinary memory and recall and the ability to pull things up instantaneously can we appreciate the Rogatchev. When Rabbi Teitz described the Rogatchev, he said, it's not that the Rogatchev had an extraordinary memory, it's that he had an inability to forget. Some people have a great memory, and we work on our memory, and we train memory, and we build memory palaces. And those who've taken on the new daf have promised this cycle we're going to employ our memory. The Rogatchev didn't have a great memory. He had an inability to forget anything. And there are several stories of that Rogatchev's inability to forget told over by Rabbi Teitz. Rav Meir Simcha wrote the Sefer Meshech Chachma. Many of us know Rav Meir Simcha through his wonderful work on Torah, on Chumash, on Parsha, called the Meshech Chachma. Rav Kuperman Zatzal from Michala put out an edition of the Meshech Chachma with brilliant footnotes that helped us understand it even further because it's a very sophisticated work. He wrote it when he was only 17 years old to give you some sense of the Meshech Chachma's genius. So what happened? His father, even at 17, he was getting advice from his father despite writing the Meshech Chachma. And his father said to him, listen, you're going to have a problem. If your first work that you put out is Meshech Chachma and Parsha, people are going to dismiss you. You're a Parsha guy. You're a Parsha guy. You're not really a Talmud Chacham. You're not a Lamdan. You're not a Posek. You're not a Reshiva. You're not a Gadol. You don't really know how to learn. You're putting out on the Parsha. So shelve the Meshech Chachma and do something else first. So Meir Simcha, at the young age of 17, was convinced by his father, and he put the Meshech Chachma manuscript up on a shelf, and instead he turned to publish the Or Sameach. The Or Sameach is Meir Simcha's penetrating analysis on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. He published it and he earned a reputation as an outstanding Talmud Chacham. But when Rabbi Teitz met Rav Meir Simcha and learned of the writing of the Meshech Chachma, he thought it was a waste that it was never published. Even after the Or Sameach and the Rambam came out, Rav Meir Simcha never returned to publish the original work at 17, the Meshech Chachma. So Rabbi Teitz suggested a young man from Slobodka, we'll get to where Rabbi Teitz went to go learn in Slobodka, and he had a colleague, a chaver in Slobodka, Rav Avin David Yaffe, who edited the work, which is now recognized as one of the great commentaries on Chumash. So for all we know, the world would not have a Meshech Chachma if not for the fact that Rabbi Teitz encouraged and found a young man to edit and work on and publish and release the Meshech Chachma we enjoy today. Tragically, that young man was murdered by the Nazis, Hashem Yikom Damo, but the work of Meshech Chachma is his monument of that young man who helped release it. Later in 1981, Rabbi Teitz also printed Tshuvas of Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. So while certainly he gained from that extraordinary relationship, he also reciprocated by helping the Meshech Chachma get his Torah out. The Rogatchev also, as I said, it was only the invention of the computer that gave words, the Rogatchev's memory. His works were saved by his daughter. There's really an amazing, amazing story of how this happened. It's not for now. Perhaps we'll do a series on the Rogachever. But in 1939, 1940, when the Nazis were destroying Europe, the Rogachever's daughter, Rachel Citron, feared that the Nazis would reach Dvinsk. She was living in Petah Tikva at the time. She had already gotten out. She was in Palestine. But she decided, and she published one volume of her father's Torah from there. But she decided that she was going to go back to rescue her father's writings. And she returned, taking great risk to her life, actually in the end costing her life, and she microfilmed her father's writing, which include references every time he wrote on the margin of a Gemara. She somehow was able to microfilm even what was written in the margins. And they managed to send these microfilms and one set of his actual Talmud. And the Nazis then ended up getting to Dvinsk, June 1941. They burned the Rogachever's whole library, and they murdered his daughter, who gave her life in order to rescue his Torah. And that treasure remained for years. They had sent all that microfilm, and they had sent that set of Talmud with the notes to cousins in the Bronx, until one of them mentioned it to Rav Menachem Kasher in a chance meeting in Peoria, Illinois. And with the help of Rabbi Belkin, Dr. Belkin, who was the president of YU, Rav Menachem Kasher established a foundation and published 13 works of the Rogachever. But there was a group that formed in order to raise the money to publish the Rogachever's Torah. Rabbi Teitz, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Rav, Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung, and in 1970 they published 7 more volumes. And here you have on the bottom right are personal checks of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Schneerson, dated 1977 and 1986, to the Joseph Rosen Publication Fund. The second check, the first check, to Rabbi M.P. Teitz to help release and publish the Rogachever's Torah. So the Rogachever, our access to the brilliance, the wisdom of the Rogachever, is really due to Rabbi Teitz, who helped. In fact, if you go to page 4 in the handout, only I didn't write 4, so it's the page after 3. It's the cover page of the third volume of the Tzafnas Paneach, which is the Rogachever Gaon's Klalei HaTorah VaMitzvos, Maron Rabbi Yosef Bar Befraim Fisher Rosen, Zecher Tzadik Kadosh Levracha, Ba'arichas, who is the editor, Mordechai Pinchas Teitz, Ad Beis Din, and Ram Elizabeth, New Jersey. He was the one who put it out. Well, you'll note that's interesting. If you turn the page, in the back of the Rogachever's Torah, he included a correspondence, a tshuva of the Rogachever. And you'll appreciate this, those who know the story. Everyone will appreciate it more in a moment. The first letter, the tshuva of the Rogachever, is written from Dvinsk. To whom? Rabbi Elazar Meir, Rav of Trenton. So when Rabbi Elazar Meir Prail was still living in Trenton, New Jersey, he had a correspondence with the Rogachever. And Rabbi Teitz, who would become Rabbi Prail's son-in-law, and release and rescue the Rogachever's Torah, included the correspondence between Rabbi Elazar Meir Prail, in Trenton at the time, and the Rogachever, Gaon. Early years. Rabbi Pinchas enrolled yeshiva in Panovich, Lithuania, as Chavrusa was Rav Shmuel Volk, who later became a Rosh Yeshiva in Ritz at YU. That's a picture of him on the top right, one of the Rosh Yeshiva at Ritz. After 2 years in Panovich, he spent a year in Riga. In Panovich, he was very disturbed by what he saw, the phenomenon that was sweeping through the Jewish people. The Buddhists, communists, secularists, others on the Torah community, compromising our values, our priorities, and our ideals. At only 14 years old, and I found this fact astounding, when I think about where I was at 14, or when I consider, let's just say, my children at 14, he decided he had to do something about the phenomenon that he was witnessing around him. So what did he do at 14? What most 14-year-olds do? He started a yeshiva in Livanov as a project of Zeirei Agudas Yisrael. This is a letter on the right side, June 5th, 1931, from the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Friedrich Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak Schneerson, June 5th, 1931. It's written to Rabbi Teitz, encouraging this new yeshiva that he had begun as a way of, as a youth movement, and a way of combating the influences that he saw that was sweeping through the Torah community. He had needed a name for his yeshiva. What did he call it? It was a name that would dominate Rabbi Teitz's institutions, even publications, we'll see. He called it Yavna. Why Yavna? Because in a state of Churban, when you're worried about the Jewish people and its future, and you're seeking to preserve it, where do we have a precedent in the Talmud and the Gemara? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Tein Liyavna V'Chachmeha, and based on Tein Liyavna V'Chachmeha, Rabbi Teitz named that yeshiva at 14 years old Yavna, and he had the support and encouragement of the 6th Rebbe. Then he goes to Slobodka. Knesset Yisrael, the yeshiva in Slobodka, one of the most prominent yeshivas of the time. His older brothers had studied there, and in 1924 he enrolled to learn from the Alter of Nassen Tzvi Finkel. His emphasis was on the greatness of man, and therefore the uniqueness of every individual. Now is not the time to elaborate on the different schools of thought in Musar, which are Shiflas Ha'adam, Godless Ha'adam, Kelm, Slobodka, Navardik. What do we emphasize that will most likely encourage a person to grow, to transform, to aspire? What provides the ambition? When we realize, I'm a gornisht, I'm next to nothing, I'm worm food, I'm unworthy, I'm inconsequential, is that what will motivate? Or is it godless Adam? When you tell that we're just below God, we're with the angels, the greatness, the uniqueness, the singularity of man, the Bishvili Nivar Olam, the world was created for every one of us. And if we appreciate our singularity and uniqueness, our personal mission and our greatness, the godless Adam, then we will strive what we can achieve. I read once description of Slobodka, that there was a tailor on staff in Slobodka. The altar of Slobodka would not allow a bachar to enter the Beis Medrash if he was missing a button or if he had a tear. And remember, in those days, you had one garment. You wore it for a whole year till you went home Pesach and you got a new pair of pants. You got a new suit jacket. And nevertheless, despite its wear and tear, the altar, in trying to instill a sense of being royal, being regal, godless ha'adam, the greatness of man, had certain expectations of punctuality, expectations of appearance, expectations of discipline in order to create that atmosphere, in order to elicit the greatness of man. There in Slobodka on the top right is his identification picture and registration card at the Rabbinical Seminary Knesset Yisrael, a wonderful picture of the young Rabbi Pinchas Teitz. He made lifelong friends. Slobodka, you know, was an extraordinary place by its graduates. And when you think about the who's who of 20th century America, the leadership who preserved the continuity of the Jewish people and gave it such a bright future that we benefit from today, they were graduates of Slobodka, influenced by the altar's belief in them, his faith in the greatness of man. Just to name a few of the graduates, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, the great Rosh Hashiva of Torah Badas, Rav Yaakov Ruderman, the founding Rosh Hashiva of Ner Yisrael, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, the great Pachad Yitzchak, Chaim Berlin, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri Dei Eish, and Rabbi Teitz maintained relationships with these Gedolim throughout his life. On the bottom is a picture of him and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, obviously later in life. His time in Slobodka clearly had an enormous impact on him. And I'll give you just one description, and this is a personal memory I have. If you saw the way Rabbi Teitz walked, he was a reflection of Slobodka. He was never slouched, he was never bent over. He was never running like he was late, or rushing, or walking too slowly. There was something regal about his appearance. There was something about the way that he walked, and the way he walked into a room, it spoke of godless ha'adam. A person felt the presence of greatness, not arrogance or hubris, but the greatness that we are princes and princesses. We are royalty. We're children of Hashem, the godless ha'adam. My mother describes having spent a lot of time in that home when she was a young girl, sharing great friendship with Rabbi Teitz's daughters, never seeing Rabbi Teitz in a casual appearance, never seeing him in a casual posture, that Rabbi Teitz's greatness, whether it was the public persona that the world saw or in the privacy of his own home, Slobodka went through him through and through. The altar clearly embedded within him that notion of godless ha'adam, the greatness of man. I contrast this, now you walk in the street and people are paying extra money for there to be holes and rips and the jeans. The more it looks like they got it for free from the Salvation Army, the more expensive it costs. It ain't shiflas ha'adam gedola mizu. I mean, that's how low we have fallen, that we pay a premium to look homeless. There's something very backwards about it. That doesn't produce greatness. What produced these leaders of 20th century American Orthodoxy, and I just gave you the list of the who's who, geniuses of great character, but who also believed in themselves and believed in a bright future, it's an emphasis on godless ha'adam. When you have a tailor on staff, and when you talk about punctuality and discipline and dignity, and that you tell people you're princes, you're royalty, then you produce such outstanding individuals. He also learned activism at that young age. Rav Mordechai Dubin, 1889 to 1956, was a member of the Latvian parliament and a founder of Agudas Yisrael of Latvia. You can almost feel his presence on the picture on the top right. He worked closely with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was a Lubavitcher of Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the sixth Rebbe. And when the Rebbe was imprisoned, because every Rebbe has to be imprisoned so that we have a reason to fabreng later, when the sixth Rebbe got out of prison, partially due to the advocacy, activism, and lobbying of this Mordechai Dubin. Rabbi Teitz attached himself to this Dubin. Dubin attached himself to Rabbi Teitz because even at a young age, he showed such promise of leadership, his oratory skills, his charisma, his ambition, and therefore he was a natural to be involved in Jewish communal leadership. You may not know this, but Zev Jabotinsky heard about Rabbi Teitz and actually tried to recruit him to be a spokesperson and a bridge to the Haredi Torah world to bring the message of Aliyah, of Zionism, and that Rabbi Teitz, if anybody could bring that message and create that bridge, it would be him. In 1932, at the request of Dubin, Rabbi Teitz met Rav Yecheskel Abramsky at the train station. He was released from his 2 years in Siberia. Rav Abramsky later became the head of the London Beis Din, moved to Israel, and they maintained a relationship. Rabbi Teitz had maybe one of the greatest Rolodexes in the Jewish world. And it wasn't superficial contact. He had deep relationship with Gedolei Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Shach. He met the Chazon Ish right before he died. And certainly the Gedolim of America, he knew them all. And if you doubt it, look through Rav Elazar Meir Teitz's wedding album. And if you want to know who was at that wedding, it was the who's who of Gedolei Yisrael. That's a picture also of a young, handsome Rabbi Pinchas Teitz. 1933. Is when it all began, is when it all changed to our advantage here in America. Rav Elimeir, Eliyahu Meir Bloch, on behalf of Tells, was scheduled to go to America to speak and to raise funds. And he asked around and he was looking for a young man, a bachur, who'd be able to join him. It'd be lonely to be on the road, but to go city to city to give shiurim and raise funds if he had someone. And he identified the perfect person. Rabbi Teitz was the editor of a journal called Our Voice, the head of a religious youth movement, the founder of this yeshiva Yavna, a rabbi in Pavonia. And Rabbi Teitz was adventurous. He wanted to, he had heard about America, the New World, and he wanted to see for himself what was going on. He was the perfect candidate. Before they left, they made a promise to one another that every day, despite the hardship of being on the road, it's not like travel today, where if the Wi-Fi is slow, I can't believe this airline, the world is caving in. You know, the train rides and the days that it took to go and the living quarters and the access to kosher food and the like. But they promised one another that they would learn together a minimum of 1 hour. Dr. Blau has in her book a story where on that last day before they separated, because Rav Eliyahu Meir Bloch went back to Europe before Rabbi Teitz, they had been up the whole night meeting with people before the goodbye. It was a couple hours before Rav Bloch had to leave. He said, let me close my eyes. And a few minutes after he fell asleep, he jumped up in his bed, startled. He said, wait, we didn't learn today. It was the first day that they hadn't learned, and they had made a promise that they would learn together for an hour every day. On that trip, they went to Cleveland, Detroit, Los Angeles, Miami, Montreal, Toronto, and other cities. And despite it being a depressed economy in America, the desire to help support a yeshiva in Lithuania really was something remarkable. At a convention of Agudas Rabbanim 2 years later, he would reflect on that trip, because that was Rabbi Teitz's first exposure to the American scene and what was happening. What was Jewish community like here? And he said, we have to teach about Jewish marriage, and we have to found day schools and learn English, or we're going to lose the next generation. This is the beginning of Rabbi Teitz showing us that he understood, now we have to impose the European standards on America, but it's a new world. And if we don't learn their language, literally and figuratively, we will lose the next generation of Jews in America. He actually, at this Agudas Rabbanim, stood up as a young man and lectured about that. And you know what the Agudas Rabbanim did? They canceled his membership, sent him back his money, and berated him for the fact that he had the gall to stand up and give advice to Rabbanim, much his senior. He saved that letter. He saved that letter, I imagine, as a prized possession, because he had, I would say, the last laugh, but it was the last cry, that in fact, he was right about all the things he was saying and called for. He didn't have a degree himself, but he recommended rabbis go to college for two reasons. Number one, to be educated. The more educated, the more articulate, the more compelling, the more persuasive, the more you could communicate the Torah's timeless messages to a broader audience. But also, he did for another reason. He said, if a rabbi has a college education, he could look at the community and say, I'm not afraid to say what needs to be said, and I'm not afraid to have the policies that we need to have. Because you know what? I'll be an accountant, a lawyer, a doctor. I can have another career. I don't need you. I'm not desperate for your money. So if a rabbi had a backup plan, then he would have the backbone, the boldness, to be able to stand up and say what needed to be said. You see already his entrepreneurship. Because on that trip, he's a young man, he's a bacher, the junior partner on the trip, he had business cards printed that he could hand out that said, Rav Pinchas Meir Teitz, representing a movement to organize a militant Jewish youth organization throughout the world. I don't know how you fit that on a business card, but that is a very bold, that is a very ambitious business card. There was no such organization. It was him. He was the movement. His dream, his ambition already at that young age in that first visit was a youth organization throughout the world. Note the word militant. Not with its negative connotation of today that he was going to take up arms or be violent, but militant in the sense of unapologetic, unabashed, unashamed, willing to go out and to fight for who we are and what we stand for. Now put that story on hold and let's turn to another story that's unfolding simultaneously. Rabbi Elazar Meir Pearl was married more than 10 years. He did not have any children. His wife finally conceived only to die with the baby at childbirth. A tragedy that's unimaginable. And he decided, Mashana Makom, Mashana Mazel, that was a sign it was time to move and to start a new life in another country. He went to London as a fundraiser for TELS. He went to Manchester to serve as a rabbi. And finally, he made his way to the United States. There he married Frida Mann, who had come from Lithuania to visit her married sister. And together, now he was successful in having four children, Basia, Chana, Sarah, and Yoshua Yosef. Even though they were living in America, they spoke Yiddish in their home, and they had Litvish customs, and so much about that home was parallel to the Teitz home in Europe. Even though they were on opposite sides of the ocean, because of where Rabbi Elazar Meir Pearl had come from, there was so much they had in common. First, he was a rabbi in Trenton, as we saw in the Rogacheva's correspondence. The Rogacheva wrote a tshuva to Rabbi Elazar Meir of Trenton in 1919, and then in Elizabeth, all the while teaching Gemara 1912 to 1924, Yeshiva Seitz Chaim, which ultimately became Yeshiva University. That is a picture of the Prales, Rabbi and Rebbetzin Prale. Now, you'll give me personal privilege to insert this slide to explain to you why tonight has great meaning to me. My great-grandfather, Yonah Gedalia Aboff, was a reverend in Elizabeth. Some of you are the age to understand that reverend, he did not convert from another faith. Reverend was the name of the sexton, the gabbai, the shamish of the shul, the kolbo of the community, who was knowledgeable and trained and would be an incredible resource for the community. He learned in Kishinev, there's a story not for now, of how he arrived in Kishinev the day after the Kishinev pogrom, not having known the pogrom happened. And when he came and was walking the streets that were empty of Jews and wondering, hey, where did everyone go? And suddenly a door opened, someone grabbed him and pulled him in and said, are you crazy? Do you know what's happening? It was the day after the pogrom. He became trained as a sheikhet. He had relatives in America and he ultimately emigrated to Elizabeth to be the shochet under Rabbi Prale. And that's why I told you that my family, my great-grandparents, actually were in Elizabeth even before Rabbi Teitz had arrived. My great-grandfather was the shochet under Rabbi Teitz as well, and he was the balkori in the community. And in fact, it was one of the few homes, we're going to see in a moment when Rabbi Teitz comes to Elizabeth, what he discovers in terms of the level of ignorance and the poor level of observance in the community, one of the few homes that the Teitzes were allowed by their parents to eat in, not the Teitzes, that Bessie, Rabbi Prale's children, were allowed to eat in, was the Aboff home, that of my great-grandparents in Elizabeth. Ultimately, they had a son, Sam, my grandfather, for whom my son is named, Shmuel Yisrael Nassim. The Shmuel is my grandfather, Sam E. Aboff. He married my grandmother, Ruth Mullman, from Newark, and they lived in Elizabeth their whole lives. That picture on the right, which we'll come back to, which actually hangs in my office and I look at every single day. I don't know if the Teitzes have my grandparents on their wall, but I have their grandfather on my wall. So I'll tell you exactly what's happening right now. My grandfather, growing up in Elizabeth, to be a religious man, you know, we've discussed many times, you got fired every Friday when you refused to work on Shabbos. So if you wanted to be a Shomer Shabbos and grow up in America in those years, he went into public education. The job that he could have, where he could have a career and not have to compromise on Shabbos, was to go into public education. He started on the bottom and he worked his way up. And at this point, he worked his way up and he was appointed the superintendent of the entire public school system of Elizabeth, New Jersey. And at the end of his career, one of the public schools in Elizabeth was named in his honor. It's called the Sam E. Aboff House, one of the public schools in Elizabeth. And I remember being there myself at this event. Those are my grandparents on the left. That's Rabbi Teitz on the right. Standing next to Rabbi Teitz is the mayor of Elizabeth. Who remembers his name? Mayor Dunn. In fact, today I found a letter of Mayor Dunn written to my grandfather, thanking him for helping get him elected. So that is a portrait of my grandfather that hangs until today in that building in Elizabeth. And why would Rabbi Teitz, I was reflecting with my mother today, why would Rabbi Teitz speak at an event naming one of the public schools in the public school system of the state of New Jersey? That's a reflection both of Rabbi Teitz's significance in Elizabeth, but also of the closeness between my grandparents and the Teitzes. And we'll come back to that. There are two great stories about Rav Elazar Meir Prale. One of them is a story about his table, and you have it on pages 1 and 2 and 3. It's a story about his daughters and what happened at that Shabbos table. Dr. Blau tells a version of the story in her book. This is from, hopefully you'll still talk to me after I tell you this, this is a footnote in the book Making of a Gadol. You're holding it, we're all in Chayrim together now. So, in this book, Making of a Gadol, by Rav Nelson Kamenetsky, he tells the following story. It's on the first page, where the arrow is. There was a special stress Lubavitch Yeshiva put on interpersonal relations. It's apparent in his tone that he was unsure whether to tell the story to his interviewers. This was a story that the Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael, Rav Ruderman, told. In the early 1930s, he was invited to spend the Shabbos at the home of the Rav of Elizabeth, Rav Elazar Meir Prale. Before the arrival of the Shabbos, the Rav took him aside for a confidential exchange of words. He told his guests he had several daughters eating at the Shabbos table, who enjoyed Shabbos by singing Zmiras along with him. At this point, Rav Ruderman interjected, there were no Beis Yaakov schools in America, fine. The Rav told him that Rav Baruch Ber Leibovitz had been a guest at his home in 1929, and when the girls began singing, he stood up and ran out of the room, unintentionally perturbing the Shabbos of the girls and humiliating their father. The host then asked whether Rav Ruderman would do the same. Rav Ruderman replied that with his Slobodka background, he would not destroy a family Shabbos spirit or embarrass his host. He would remain sitting and simply not listen to the girls, despite the seeming normative halachic imperative to leave the room. My frumkeit does not have to hurt others, he concluded. So Rav Nelson Kamenetsky includes this story as a reflection of Slobodka, that the graduates of Slobodka didn't have to make a show, a display of being a zealot, a kanai. A graduate of Slobodka understood my frumkeit doesn't hurt others, and that he'd be willing to sit at that table. If you turn the page, you'll see on the bottom in the footnote, he does continue by quoting Dr. Blau in her book. Dr. Blau denies the accuracy of this story, and claims in the name of her mother and aunt, Basia and Chana, respectively, said daughters of the Rav, Rav Elazar Meir Prale, that when the girls began singing, a student accompanying Rav Baruch Ber spoke up to his Rebbe and asked why he was not leaving the room. And Rav Baruch Ber said, when prayers are being recited, there's no problem with Kol Isha, they're praying with a melody. On March 2003, a nephew of Basi reported he heard from her that the girls were singing Birchas HaMazon, Natzmiros, their father had composed a tune they were using at the time, and so on. But he concludes here, on August 6, 2003, Rav Elazar Meir Teitz, brother of Dr. Blau, reported that Rav Baruch Ber's accompanying student was his son-in-law, Rav Grozovsky, and his exact reply was, they're only praising the one above with a melody. Anyway, as Rav Nelson Kamenetsky does, he goes into that story. But Rav Elazar Meir Prale had his daughters. What I like is, he sang Zmiros at the table with his daughters, and how other visiting Gedolim reacted or responded or dealt with it is a subject of debate, but he sat at the table singing Zmiros with his daughters. Another story, a somewhat famous story of Rav Elazar Meir Prale, is a fascinating story. Listen to this story. On the last evening of his life, a day before Sukkot, Rabbi Prale was concerned. It was the night before Sukkot, and the sets of Dalad Minim of the community had been delivered to him, but had not yet been distributed to the community. So there was no Rabbi Sugarman's house, and it wasn't given out in the back of the shul, and there was no Judaica store, and you didn't order it online from Amazon. The Rav took a delivery of the Arba Minim for the community, and then you came, and they were given out to the community. And all of a sudden, Rabbi Elazar Meir Prale has a premonition. It's the night before Sukkot, and he realizes that if he were to die that night, his one son, who was only 8 years old, would inherit all the sets of Dalad Minim. There's a problem. An 8-year-old can acquire, can inherit, but he can't be makna. He can't pass it on, distribute it. He can't give it to someone else. A minor can inherit, but can't transfer the ownership. So how would the community fulfill the mitzvah? There's no way for them to halachically acquire. So he called a rabbi 3 miles away and asked him to come as quickly as possible. And he said, I feel the end is near. So he transferred the ownership of the Dalad Minim to that rabbi from the neighboring community. So if something would happen to him, they would still have their Dalad Minim. And Kachava, that night, Rabbi Prale passed away. And therefore, he did a great thing for the community who would have had no Dalad Minim. His son would have had a lot of Dalad Minim, but the rest of the community would have had none if not for that halachic creativity and that premonition. Now, Rabbi Pearl himself was a leader, and he was a leader ahead of his time. He started a Jewish day school, but it didn't last. And so his children went to public school, and they had a Jewish tutor. His eldest daughter, Basia, known as Bessie, had an amazing classmate and friend in that public school, whose name was Sam Aboff, otherwise known by me and my siblings as Zeta, my grandfather. One of Basia's teachers told her once, quote, "A rabbi's daughter will not get into the honor society. I'll make sure of it." The same teacher who had graduated Barnard would comment to the class that her alma mater rarely accepted Jewish applicants. This was a time that there were people unapologetic. I said, this was a time. Chalila, it's becoming that time again. But it was a time that people publicly were unabashedly anti-Semitic. And in that public school system, there was this teacher who told Bessie or Basia that she would never get into honor society, and her alma mater, proudly she would flaunt, Barnard did not take a lot of Jews. Well, fast forward 50 years, Mrs. Teitz ran into another teacher from her childhood from that public school who mentioned she was going to see that anti-Semitic teacher who was living in an old age home. So Bessie Teitz said, "Do me a favor, when you go visit her, tell her that Bess Prale has 5 daughters and they all graduated Barnard." And then she called each of her daughters and she said to them, "This was my triumph over that anti-Semitic teacher." To which, at least the way Dr. Blau says, they all said, "That's why I had to go to Barnard? So that you could have this moment of triumph over that teacher? You had a bad day at school and I had to go to Barnard?" In any case, her daughters all went to Barnard and were educated. That was her victory over anti-Semitism. That is a young Bessie Prale, a young Rebbetzin Teitz. People were vying for the rabbinical position, but Rabbi Prale had written in his will that it should go to the man Basia would marry. In fact, he had put that in the will so much so that Reb Lazer Silver, Malcolm Morris's grandfather, who we're going to have a whole session about, also one of the instrumental, we would not have Orthodoxy in America, his efforts were extraordinary. So he led the funeral for Rabbi Prale, and he refused to begin the funeral until the community agreed that that condition would be met, that not anyone who was vying for the position, but only Bessie or Basia's husband would be the one who would assume the rabbinical position leadership of Elizabeth. My grandfather remembered, this did not appear in Dr. Blau's book, believe it or not, but he remembered that while the community was in this interim stage, bereft of a rabbi, Rabbi Prale had passed away and passed away suddenly, and Bessie had not married, so there was no new rabbi, that in that interim, people came to her with their halachic questions because she best remembered what her father said, and she sort of served in that capacity while they waited for a rabbi. November 3rd, the Shloshim of Rabbi Prale happened to correspond with the day that Rav Elio Meir Bloch and Rav Pinchas Teitz arrived in New York for their fundraising trip. 30 days after Rabbi Prale was taken, the Ribbono Shalom placed Rabbi Teitz on these shores. In June of 1934, the young rabbi from Latvia and the daughter of the rabbi of Elizabeth overlapped at a dinner, and they found that they enjoyed each other's company. Now, to have overlapped at the dinner, they had to be seated together, near each other, be at the same dinner. Nobody said, "Where's your resume? Let me see." Rabbi Teitz didn't say, "Send it to my mother. She's deciding who I should go out with." But they overlapped at that dinner. They took a liking to one another. They enjoyed each other's company. And they had much in common. The love of Torah. They spoke a pure aristocratic Yiddish. They had great aspirations, which is fascinating because remember that she was born and raised in America and he in Europe. They were on other sides of the universe, let alone the ocean. And yet, that's the power of Torah and the power of Yiddishkeit, that with all the differences culturally and with language, they spoke the same language and they lived the same Torah culture. They had so much in common. When they decided to marry, Rabbi Teitz wrote his parents, having promised that he married in the U.S., he would bring his bride to meet them and to decide if they would live in the U.S. or Europe. In that letter, he wrote, "She's nechmada, yafa, v'chachama. She's delightful, beautiful, and smart." And said that her father was one of the most esteemed rabbis in America. Rabbi Teitz obviously never met his father-in-law, Rabbi Elazar Meir Prale. They got married Sunday, January 1935. And I love this. The headline in the Elizabeth Daily Journal. Nebuch on whoever paid for that wedding. 1500, see Miss Bessie Prale wed rabbi, fulfilling the last wish of her father. That was the headline. It's a beautiful headline. 1500 people. I don't know if they were invited to just the chuppah or the whole thing. I'm not sure how they worked it out. 1,500 people see Bessie Prale fulfill her father's dying wish, and she marries a rabbi, and that is their wedding picture. That's what a graduate of Slobodka looked like. Tall, standing erect, proud, dignified, regal, royal, beautiful. They left the next week on their honeymoon to Europe. It wasn't a honeymoon, it was a fulfillment of the promise to see his parents. The Dvar Avrohom, Rav Avrohom Kana Shapiro, the Rav of Kovna, hosted a wedding party in their honor. And there in Kovna, Rabbi Teitz gave a shir for Agudas Yisrael. They then, of course, naturally went to Dvinsk to see the Rogachover and his wife to introduce his new Rebbetzin to them. They returned to Elizabeth before Pesach, and they returned to live with, if you think your life is rough in any way, they lived with his mother-in-law, two aunts, and an uncle. Baruch Hashem. On the Taitz's first Shabbos in Elizabeth, on his way to Shul, a Jewish man rolled down the window to ask the rabbi if he needed a ride. And this vignette tells you two things about the city of Elizabeth at its time. The people were really nice. It was in New Jersey, after all. The people were, not the other side of the Hudson, it was, the people were really nice, first of all, and the people also were really ignorant. The fact that this new rabbi, Talmud Chochem, a graduate of Telz and Ponovich and Slobodka, that you'd roll down the window and say, "Hey, Rabbi, do you need a ride to shul?" showed Rabbi Teitz very quickly that people were very nice as well as very ignorant. On the first Simchas Torah, there was only one other person who joined them to dance. Everyone else ran to work. That is hardly hakafas. That is hardly hakafas. He knew Yiddish, Hebrew, Aramaic, German, Latvian, Lithuanian, and Russian, but it was time to learn English. So towards that end, he would read the New York Times together with his wife. They studied Shakespeare and Milton because Rabbi Teitz said, "If I have to learn a language, I want to read the masterpieces in it. Why should I read some, you know, Learn English 101? Why should I listen to Rosetta Stone on English? If I need to learn English, I might as well also be acquiring the masters in that language." And then I love this. Rabbi Teitz, beginning, had to speak on Shabbos. And he was the one who advocated, if you want to reach people in the new world, you have to speak the new language. You have to speak English. But he didn't know English yet. So he would recite his drasha in Yiddish to his Rebbetzin, to his wife. She would write it in English, transliterating it, using it Hebrew script. So when he stood up and gave a drasha to the community in those early years, which it'll be hard to believe, I'm going to play some of Rabbi Teitz speaking English for you later, but when you hear his English, it's hard to believe he didn't speak a word of English. And she had to, using Hebrew characters, transliterate for him to be able to deliver a drasha in the English. He was invited to many prominent positions in New York, but he felt a responsibility to the community of his late father-in-law. And he wanted to build a true kehila. He wanted to recreate a true sense of a community. He felt he'd make a greater contribution by accepting full responsibility for the needs of an entire small community than being one rav among many in a big community. That was his conclusion. And he made a halachic argument for it. The Balei Musar give this argument as well. And they say the following. When it comes to the laws of Lecha Mishnah, if I have before me to make hamotzi on a Friday night, I have an enormous sheva brachas challah, but some kid pulled off the end, so it's missing a piece. Or if a tiny little challah roll, but it's a shalem, it's whole, it's complete, which one do I use for hamotzi? What do I use for Lecha Mishnah? I use the shalem, which the Balei Musar say, better to be small but shalem than to be big but incomplete. And that was Rabbi Teitz's argument. Better to have a small community but be shalem, create a real sense of a kehila, a community, and be small, than to be part of a huge place but it's so fragmented, splintered, and incomplete. Before he turned his attention to building a kehila in Elizabeth, he had a grave concern for the Jews of Europe. He wrote to his family and friends, arranged tickets and visas for anyone that he could. He went to a senator from New Jersey in 1940 with the idea, not his own, it was being shared by many, pay $100 for each Jewish person allowed to emigrate. But the senator said, "Rabbi, it's an election year. We can't talk about Jewish things. Again, we take for granted, and even with the recent rise in anti-Semitism, remember, and this has nothing to do with the Rabbi Teitz talk, but remember, even right now, as horrific as what happened in Muncie and in Jersey City and Pittsburgh and Poway and so on, the day after what happened in Muncie, the President of the United States, the Speaker of the House, the Governor, legislators all spoke out against anti-Semitism and put measures in place to protect Jews. That was not what happened in those days. And therefore, in fact, you remember, there was a great debate whether Jews could even be talking out loud about trying to save Jews from Europe, because maybe we'll just elicit anti-Semitism on these shores as well. And that's what the senator told Rabbi Teitz. He was a member of the delegation of rabbis, the 400 rabbis who went to see President Roosevelt, but who were turned away. We remember that Roosevelt's diary showed that he was doing nothing that day, but he refused to meet with them nonetheless. He worked with Rabbi Eliezer Silver to rescue Jews through the Vat Hatzalah, and that is a picture on the right of a young Rabbi Teitz here in America, and on the left, Malka's grandfather, Rabbi Silver, whom you'll learn a lot more about from Rabbi Moskowitz soon. Their family. Their first child, Elazar Meir, was named for his maternal grandfather. He was brilliant, still is brilliant. Wanted to go into math, would have been a brilliant mathematician. And in the family, it is said that he knew how to read Hebrew and English both at 3 years old. Next time you speak to him, ask him if that's true. They compromised on family tradition. Rabbi Teitz stood for Kiddush. But Bessie, whose father was a Talmud Chacham and Rav, used to sit, so he let her sit. The men stood and the women sat. They alternated tunes for Zmiros, alternated stanzas or alternated weeks of the Zemer. Rabbi Teitz adopted the customs of his father-in-law. For example, we know famously from Elizabeth, and the Elizabethans here know, that you do not use parsley or potato for karpas. What do you use? Bananas. And why was that? That was not Rabbi Teitz's creation. That was inherited from Rabbi Elazar Meir Prel. Why did he say that? Because the bracha you make for karpas is a bracha of adama. Most people mistakenly think that a banana gets a eitz. Rabbi Elazar Meir Prel creatively said, if we use bananas for karpas, we'll kill two birds with one banana. We will both fulfill the mitzvah of karpas, and we'll also educate the youth that the proper bracha on a banana is adama. You could use $130,000 banana from a piece of artwork from Miami if you want as well. Rabbi Teitz also has a famous shita for how many slices you have to wash on. He and the Rebbetzin had six children: Elazar Meir, Hadassah, Rivka, Shalamis, Abby, and Elisheva. Rivka, of course, is Dr. Rivka Blau, married to the Mashgiach of Yeshiva University, Rabbi Blau, herself a great educator, an accomplished educator. Rav Elazar Meir, who took over as the Rav of the community, the Rav Ha'ir afterwards. Shalomitz Resnick, who has the great distinction and envy and our pity of being the mother-in-law of Rabbi Seth Grossman. That was a little shout-out to my buddy Seth. And Abby Rabin in Englewood, New Jersey, and Ellie, who lives in Teaneck. April 1935, a meeting of Rabbi Teitz to reveal his plans and goals. He stood up. And can you imagine the community assembled for him to say his plans, what he was going to do for Elizabeth? And his first announcement was, I'm moving. I need to leave. You need to leave. You just got here. You were the rabbi. You wanted to build the small community. Why do you have to leave? Because the community has no mikvah. And the halacha is you cannot live in a community that has no mikvah. People said, but you could use the mikvah in Newark. You could use the mikvah in Jersey City. You could use the mikvah in New York. Rabbi Teitz said, if we're going to be a Torah community, the first and the holiest institution in a community is the mikvah. But it was prohibitively expensive. They needed a whopping $3,000 in order to build it. So Rabbi Teitz was a brilliant fundraiser. First of all, that fundraising tactic to stand up and say, it's nice knowing you, I gotta leave, even before I've unpacked, because I just realized there's no mikvah and I can't live here. There's no mikvah. That is an excellent fundraising tactic. When Rabbi Prel died, a very wealthy individual had begun to build a mausoleum for his brother in the Jewish cemetery, and Rabbi Teitz had to turn his attention, using skills of diplomacy, to tell him that a mausoleum is not consistent with Jewish law. A concert was scheduled to be held in the shul with a prominent chazan with an organ. Rabbi Teitz held that even though technically there's nothing wrong with having an organ play in a shul on a weekday, but if you remember, there was a bitter battle taking place with the other denominations at the time, who had introduced an organ to the service on Shabbos and Yontif. And Rabbi Teitz felt to have an organ in the shul, even on a weekday, would be wrong and usher. And so he told that chazan, you could use either another instrument, or you could bring a backup chazan, you cannot play with an organ. And the chazan refused, and he canceled the concert. And these are all examples just of how weak and poor the observance was at the time in America. Elizabeth is not the exception. It was the norm, the level of ignorance, and the level of courage Rabbi Teitz had to have. Can imagine, you're coming, you're the European rabbi, you're bringing those standards from the other world, and all the pressure is on you to adapt and conform, but he refused. Instead, he stood strong, using the courage he developed in Slobodka and beyond. Nobody had a sukkah or a dal of minim. Taitzes cut down the hedges in their backyard. They built a balcony. They built a sukkah for everyone to see. And they invited everyone to be able to use the sukkah to introduce the use of a sukkah as a normative practice in the community. They were a team. Rabbi and Rebbetzin Taitz. They worked together. In fact, she has a story in here. Those who daven in the JEC know the women's sections are the balconies on top. And he describes he was sitting in the front of the shul. I still remember exactly where my grandfather's seat was, on the right side, 5-6 benches back. And he was sitting, this individual was sitting towards the front of the shul, and Rabbi Taitz approached the podium, the shtender, in order to speak or make announcements at the end of shul. And this individual says he heard a voice come from above. And he thought, wow, God is talking to Rabbi Taitz. And then he thought, wow, God is a woman. That's a female voice. And then he looked up and he saw the Rebbetzin leaning over the balcony, whispering to Rabbi Taitz to remind him exactly who he needed to acknowledge and welcome and offer a mazel tov to, and so on. I related to that because just this Shabbos, I was getting such similar instructions. And I got an email on Sunday from someone who thought it's so cute how the rabbi and Rebbetzin can lip read one another from so far away. So I can identify with that story of their partnership. September 1935, Rabbi Taitz incorporated the Rabbi E.M. Prale Central Talmud Torah. Teachers had to be observant, knowledgeable, and an engaging personality. Again, he came on a mission. He didn't just come. Many Rabbanim at that time were very happy to have a position, a pulpit, to take their paycheck and to sit and learn Torah all day. That was not Rabbi Taitz. He came with an agenda. He came with a mission. He was militant for an international youth organization that would save the continuity of the Jewish people. And his first act was a mikvah, taras hamishpacha, to bring purity. And the second act was 1935, the Rabbi E.M. Prale Central Talmud Torah. When it was up and running, it was time to open full day school. People objected, arguing public school meets their needs. They can't support or sustain a day school. We had a speech on Shabbos morning several months ago that described the resistance that people gave towards this movement of day schools. What do we need it? You're going to be an outsider. You'll never get ahead. You'll never get a job. You'll never get an education. We're trying to fit in. We can't afford it. It'll never happen. And Rabbi Taitz, when it was accused, you're opening a yeshiva and a day school because you're trying to make rabbis, Rabbi Taitz had a great response. He said, I know what rabbis go through. I would never wish that on any child. Have no fear. That's not my agenda. That's not my agenda. In 1940, when Rabbi Taitz announced that in September he would open a yeshiva, and an officer of the shul opened his hand, pointed at his palm, and said, hair will grow on the palm of my hand before there'll be a school in Elizabeth, New Jersey. 12 parents took a chance on Rabbi Taitz and enrolled their children. Tuition was $100 a student. $100 a student. And the school met upstairs at the mikvah. The school was called Yavna. Not surprisingly, a continuation of Rabbi Taitz's efforts in Europe. He didn't have a board of education. When he was asked by his teachers, who's the board of education? He said, you're looking at him. I'm the board of education. People thought it was very unusual, not only in the schools, later in the shul, and the JEC itself too, that the rabbi appointed the board members, not the opposite way around. It was a sort of unusual structure. Among the early teachers at this school in the 1930s was Rabbi Shlomo Freifeld, the founding Rosh Hashiva of Shar Yashiv, was one of the early teachers at that school. Rabbi Taitz saw the teachers in the first 3 years of school as the most important in a child's life. They teach a joy of learning, a healthy sense of self, the people skills that someone will need. That first teacher that they'll encounter in primer age will not only give them the skill set, that will determine the trajectory of their lives and a love and a passion for Yiddishkeit and a skill set to live as a functional person, a functional Jew. And lucky for Rabbi Taitz, he had the world's greatest primer teacher ever. This is a risk, but raise your hand if you had Mrs. Ruth Aboff as a primer teacher in Elizabeth. Just Beth went up. But there's generations of those who grew up in Elizabeth. And I will read to you, this is from Dr. Blau's book, again, A Point of Personal Privilege. Ruth and Sarah Aboff, that's my grandmother and my great aunt, who were married to brothers, Jack and Sam, taught primer in first grade in the early years. Ruth was a perfect recruiter for the new school. She was American-born and college-educated. The wife of Sam Aboff, an administrator in the public school system, later became superintendent of schools of Elizabeth, taking away the argument that a child in America must go to public school. Could you imagine the head of the whole public school system used to go on the road to communities all over, but even in Elizabeth, knock on doors and say, oh, no, don't send to my schools. Your child needs to get a Jewish education. Imagine how persuasive and powerful that was. She was personable. She convinced mothers while they watched their children on the playground to try the yeshiva. And most important, a parent and a teacher in the school. Sarah and her husband Jack were multi-talented. He built a sports program. Anyone play basketball with Ray or Gary or any of the Aboffs? He built a sports program, and she wrote and directed musical performances. I still remember playing piano, my Aunt Sarah playing piano, by the students and their parents. So basically all of Elizabeth is because of the Aboffs. No, I'm just joking. What are we here to talk about? I forget. Okay. They grew out of the mikveh building, this school that started on the upstairs of the mikveh, and they wanted to rent space from the YMHA, but they were told they couldn't. So what did Rabbi Teitz do? His leadership is astounding. What he accomplished, we've barely scratched the surface. So I know you all just ate because you broke your fast, so I have plenty of time. He produced a brochure that was called, "What is Your Answer to the Problem?" What is your answer to the problem? That was the cover of the brochure. And here's how he formulated the problem. While we are deeply concerned with the physical fate of the Jewish children of Europe who are being barbarously annihilated, we are absolutely indifferent to the spiritual future of the Jewish children in this community who are drifting away from our ranks as a result of the neglect of their Jewish education. Alone, we are unable to fight the archenemy of Jewry, but it is within our power to overcome ignorance and indifference, the archenemies of Judaism. And you have here, but the hour is already late, so we're not going to read it together. But if you go to what is marked page 5, 6, and 7, you have the rest of the arguments in that brochure. Rabbi Teitz put together that brochure where he talked about the problem, too little, too late, and then he wrote what the solution is, and then he writes, our problem, now it's our plan, and now we move to our campaign. He had a whole solution to this problem. He collected data to be able to analyze the situation and to offer the most compelling argument about why there needed to be a vibrant youth movement, why there needed to be day schools and yeshivas that would combat the assimilation. May 1944, the Yavna Yeshiva bought a mansion, transformed it into a school. It was that building right there. September of that year, Yavna Yeshiva and the Rabbi E.M. Prale Central Talmud Torah united, and that was when they went under a new name together, the Jewish Educational Center. He wanted a campus that would have Torah at the center of Jewish life, that would be a vibrant place for toddlers through 120 years old. Is that not our ambition here at Boca Raton Synagogue? A campus at the center of the community, a center, not just a synagogue, that would be a place of social, educational, cultural advocacy, taking care of the vulnerable, chesed, from infancy, toddlers, until Mea V'Esrim. Every envelope that went out on behalf of the JEC had Rabbi Teitz's motto, which was learning, living, loving Torah. You have to understand that at that time, it was moving the entire opposite direction. Orthodox synagogues were being converted into conservative temples. The idea that an Orthodox education, the JEC, a Jewish Educational Center of vibrant Torah orthodoxy was being built was not only not the norm, it was entirely an anomaly and it was against all odds. Rabbi Teitz was invited to rejoin the Agudas Rabbanim, now that they realized how successful and how right he was. In 1945, he was asked to chair the Vad Hanhala, which he did until he became the president of the Agudas HaRabbanim for 2 terms. Agudas Yisrael recruited him. He worked on there. It's a good thing you're sitting down. Agudas Yisrael at the time had a Keren Aliyah that promoted moving to Israel. It was not Zionism. It was a far cry from Zionism, but it was Yishuv HaAretz. They had a Keren Aliyah, Aguda. Had a Karen Aliyah, I didn't hear it at the Sima Shas last week, about moving to Israel. And he also got involved in the rescue work of the Vad Hatzalah. In the 10 years that he had been in Elizabeth so far, 10 years, this makes me feel very, very small and unaccomplished. In the 10 years he had been in Elizabeth, he had learned English, built a mikveh, founded a yeshiva, moved the shul uptown, proposed in building a new shul in a beautiful neighborhood near the yeshiva. His credo was be modern, be Orthodox. Not modern Orthodox. It was not, he wouldn't have described Elizabeth as a modern Orthodox. He called it a modern Torah community. Not a modern Orthodox. Be modern and be Orthodox. The new shul had 3 steps, then a plaza, 5 steps, another, then 7 steps, and a plaza. It was modeled after the 15 steps leading to the Beis HaMikdash, where there was a Shir HaMalos. The 15 Shir HaMalos corresponded with those steps. I went up those steps many, many, many times, and I never knew that. I'm not sure how many of you did, that there was actual a plan to the layout of the shul and the aron inside. All the aspects of that shul were designed by Rabbi Teitz, including the steps leading up to it would be reminiscent of the Beis HaMikdash. The first adult education was in Hebrew reading and how to navigate the Siddur. In fact, in the lobby of the shul was a big poster board that had page numbers and post-it notes, or the equivalent then of post-it notes, to help a person navigate the Siddur. Because Rabbi Teitz said, if you come into this room and you need to be able to know how to daven, how could you be a practicing Jew if you can't make your way through the Siddur? March 1950, the community had a groundbreaking for another building, the elementary school and a junior high school. He traveled the country trying to convince other communities to follow his lead and to grow Jewish education. It wasn't enough that he was transforming this fledgling community in Elizabeth, but he actually was at the forefront with Torah Mesorah, and I'm going to have the privilege in February of speaking about Shimi's grandfather, Dr. Joe Kamenetsky, and who led the movement of Torah Mesorah going across the country and creating day schools everywhere. Rabbi Teitz was part of it. Rabbi Teitz Israel, his relationship with the state of Israel, this was an interesting fact. Rabbi Teitz left his radio on over Shabbos, November 28, 29, 1947, to hear the vote of the United Nations regarding the founding of the State of Israel. He'd taped the knobs so he wouldn't change them by accident. He wrote Shabbos on index cards and put them around the radio. He never did it before. He never did it after. He didn't have to worry about hurricanes in Elizabeth, New Jersey. But for that Shabbos, he left it on to be able to hear the outcome of that vote on the State of Israel. 1948, he wrote an essay, A Key to Redemption, and later that year he wrote The State of Israel and the Torah Jew, calling for a generation of redemption of builders who would establish the Jewish future. He thought the founding of the State of Israel would allow the Aguda and Mizrahi to unite, and as a person who had relationships with the leadership of both, tried to blend them together and said, now we have a State of Israel, the battle over Zionism is over, let the Torah community from both sides unite, and they told him, put your efforts elsewhere. They refused to do so. 1949, he hosted Rav Yitzchak Herzog, the chief rabbi of Israel, in Elizabeth. Just think about that date, 1949. He was already in Elizabeth. 1953, the Titus took their first trip to Israel. They stopped to visit his friend from Slobodka, the Sri De'esh. And in Israel, they visited with all the Gedol Yisrael, including the Chazon Ish, who died just a few months later. January 17th, 1953. This is one of Rabbi Titus's amazingly pioneering, really radical moves. Today, it wouldn't be. January 17th, 1953, Rabbi Teitz began the first broadcast of the Daf HaShavua, a weekly broadcast of Gemara over the radio on the WEVD, not Art Raymond, Rabbi Teitz, WEVD. Rabbi Teitz, January 17th, 1953, had this idea. You understand today that's not a big deal, that idea to buy TV time or radio time or use the internet to teach Torah, think about, you know, why you Torah and Torah anytime and Meaningful Minute and all the million WhatsApps. Today it's ubiquitous to associate learning Torah over technology. But at that time, not only was it not common, it was considered radical, it was even considered controversial. Rabbi Teitz was highly criticized by segments of the Torah community who said, how dare you? You're taking our sacred Torah, you're taking the Talmud, which is our secret language, our secret code, and you're simply providing it and broadcasting it on the radio for anyone to hear? How dare you? But the community responded, and boy did they respond. Svarim stores around New York sold out of whatever Masechta Rabbi Teitz was teaching on the radio once a week. Letters and postcards came flooding in, thanking him, including from Jews who were estranged from their Judaism, but who had attended yeshiva in Europe in their youth, and now hearing Yiddish, Shir, and Gemara over the radio brought them back, touched something in them. The radio Shir was on Motzei Shabbos. He actually took a poll of his listeners to adjust the time of when it was, 9:30 on Motzei Shabbos. After Shavuos, it was on break when the clock changed. There was opposition. He wrote a halachic argument defending it. Phenomenal halachic argument. I didn't provide it for you. But he also got support from Rav Moshe, Rav Herzog, Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Lazer Silver, and the Sri De'esh, who all came out in support that using this tool, this medium, as a way of spreading Torah was innovative and was radical, but it was also correct and meritorious, virtuous. At the completion of the first year, they had a siyum to celebrate completing the first year of the Daf HaShavu on the radio. They had no idea how many people were going to show up, because after all, they didn't have visibility of their audience. It was all virtually. It was over the radio. They had no idea how many people would come. And lo and behold, that first night, 1,000 people gathered in New York, and they heard from Rav Moshe, the Panovitcher Rav, Rav Aaron Kotler, and others who all came. Their participation in that celebration of Daf HaShavua itself was a statement of support for it. This picture on the right is the actual first address, the very first broadcast of the Daf HaShavua, which I'm going to play for you momentarily as well. Requests came in from other cities for the Daf HaShavua. Broadcast in Boston, Chicago, Detroit, LA, Miami, Montreal, Philadelphia. Now, Rabbi Teitz didn't travel to those cities, obviously, every week, but he recorded the broadcast out of New Jersey. Those tapes were sent to those other cities, and they were broadcast over the radio there as well. This is an amazing statistic. In the 1950s, with everything that was going on in the world, the American government monitored any foreign language program over the airways. They monitored to see how many people were listening, who was the demographic who was listening. They wanted to know what was going on. And they came to the Taitzes and told them that the estimated size of the audience in the 1950s each week was 200,000 people. Fast forward till today, the most viral Jewish speaker, the most popular, the most impactful, fill in whatever name you want, does not have 200, does not have 20,000 listeners a week. Maybe has 2,000. 200,000 people learning Torah together, simultaneously, collectively. Has there been such a big shear in human history? A live shear of 200,000 people listening and learning simultaneously? It's astounding. There are people who were attracted to move to Elizabeth because of the Daf HaShavua and because they identified Elizabeth as a burgeoning Torah community, if its Rav could be spreading Torah in this way. I want to pause to tell you why I find this part so meaningful to me. There's so many lessons that I, not only because of the family connection, but I, as a still young rabbi, learn from Rabbi Teitz, who managed to blend it all. But when I first started using social media to try to spread Torah, whether it was classes or articles I had written, I too received criticism. Facebook is a preacher-sticker place, and Twitter, and how could you use the internet, and you don't belong there, and you have to disconnect. And I said, Basher Hashem, you got to take the tools of our era and be able to use them. And like with Rabbi Teitz, today the very people who criticized me have the most are now calling saying, how do you get people to follow? How do you reach them? How do you link? What do you do? And so on. So I very much identify with what it took, the courage it took Rabbi Teitz, that pioneering effort, including having to face the resistance of those who protested against it. The bottom picture was the celebration, another one of the years. Enormous crowds gathered at the end of the year, the completion of each year of the Daf HaShavua. 1955, the time had come for Yeshiva High School. He built the school for boys, the JEC. A year later, he opened Beruya for the girls. The name Beruya derived certainly from the wife of Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Teitz like that, but it also was, Beruya is two names. The husband and the wife are the people who donated the money to get the school started, combined to be Beruya. So it was their names in combination together with the association with Beruya, the wife of Rebbe Meir. 1950, becomes the president of the Van Hatzalah. 1956, treasurer of Ezra's Torah. He works closely with Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin and with Rav Moshe Feinstein. The top is the picture of Rav Moshe. The bottom is a picture of him with the Lubavitch Rebbe. As I told you, it's not just that he knew the who's who. He was one of the who's who of American Gedol. In the 1950s, Orthodox students were going to university campuses and struggling with their Judaism. Student groups began to form, and in February of 1960, 80 students from different groups gathered to form a national organization. They met for the weekend, not in the Homowak, or the Pines, or the Pine View. They met in a hotel in Lakewood and spent Shabbos there trying to figure out, representing their different schools, what could we do to stem the tide of assimilation of Jews on college campus. Rabbi Teitz suggested that it be called, I'll give you one guess, Yavna. At least he's consistent. And he, with Rabbi Ralph Pelkovitz and Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, became the board of overseers of this organization, Yavna, that was addressing the issue of Jews on university campus, keeping them connected to their Judaism. Rav Soloveitchik was supportive, and when the Lubavitcher Rebbe wanted to start Chabad houses on campus, who did he turn to as a precedent and a model to follow? This organization of Yavna. He called in the Yavna leaders in order to be able to learn. Turn to page 4 in your handout. This is the last page we're going to look at together. And this comes from the Yavna studies on Parshas Noach. Yavna produced a journal, this effort on college campuses. And look at just Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, Dean of the Jewish Education Center of Elizabeth and a member of the Presidium of Agudas HaRabbanim, is advisor to the Yavna House at Princeton University. On the Pasuk, Noach was righteous. He was blameless in his generation. Rashi tells us some see it as the good and some see it for the bad. The explanation for this is Rabbi Teitz's article in Yavna. And I want to learn it with you both because I want to learn some of Rabbi Teitz's Torah in his merit, but because this piece of Torah also speaks entirely and exactly to who he was and the effort that he was leading. The explanation for the critical evaluation of Noach as contrasted to Avram has been given by the commentaries and the analogy to a person sitting in an unheated room in a cold, wintry day. He has two alternatives. He can put on a warm, heavy garment, or he can light a fire or oven. The distinction between the alternatives is that should he choose to put on an overcoat, though he would be comfortable, all those in his proximity would be as cold as before. Indeed, the sight of him in his comfort would make them feel the chill all the more by contrast. On the other hand, should he elect to bring warmth not to himself, but to the room, everyone with him would share in the warmth he caused. Both Noah and Avram found themselves in similar circumstances. Both were unique in that they lived in eras in which Hashem had been forgotten, and they alone were cognizant of his existence and of the fact that the sole purpose of man's existence is to do his will. The distinction between them was that Noah put on an overcoat. He was content to be righteous, while the rest of humanity continued in the error of its ways, a path which led inevitably to total destruction. Avram, though, did not rest on the laurels of his own righteousness. He sought to make the truth known to all who came under his influence. He kindled the fire, which was a source of light and warmth for all who came in contact with him. A question nonetheless remains in examining the criticism of our sages. Had the order of generations been reversed, had Avram preceded Noach by 10, we could understand that Noach could be considered to have fallen. But since Noach was the predecessor, how can he be criticized for not living up to the criterion that had not yet even have been established? Until Noah's time, no one had displayed the moral and spiritual courage of swimming against the stream, of being isolated and alone in his belief. To appreciate the depth, next paragraph, the depth of our sage's comment, we have to consider the generation in which Noah lived. Generations can be classified as root generations and fruit generations. The distinction in judgment between fruit and root is that the fruit of a tree is judged solely by the present, how firm and ripe the fruit is, how succulent its taste, how plentiful its juice. Roots, on the other hand, are judged not only by their hardiness in the present, but by the quality of the fruit they will eventually produce. So too with generations. Some come as the continuation of an era for which the roots were laid in the past, that are the possessors of a proud heritage of spiritual standards. They are fruit generations, which are judged by their own acts and deeds. Other generations, however, are not heirs to so well-prepared a heritage. They are not descendants, but ancestors, the ones who must show the way for others to emulate. The success and life of these root generations is judged not only by their own righteousness, but by the deeds of their successors as well. It was this lack that Chazal found in Noach. His was a root generation with no heritage from the past. His duty was not only to himself, but to the generations to follow. Yet, when Avram's time came, he was forced to begin anew. The very knowledge of Hashem's existence was forgotten, had to be freshly discovered by Avram. Thus, in Avram's generation, Noach was not considered at all. His influence was in no way felt. He did not pass the test for a root generation. So, first of all, it's a beautiful piece of Torah that Rabbi Teitz articulates. Not bad for a man who didn't learn English until an advanced age. But also, I think the Dvar Torah, Rabbi Teitz, is very much describing himself and his feeling of responsibility as a root generation in America, planting the seeds for the fruit that would grow and that were yet to come. A couple more points. We're in the home stretch. As soon as World War II ended, Rabbi Teitz urged Jews in the U.S. to establish ties those caught in Stalin's grip. When Stalin died in 53, he decided to go to the USSR despite the risk he would be detained in the country of his birth. In Russia, he traveled with the Rebbetzin. Their hotel room was bugged. They were followed. But they were able to get a sense of what was happening for the Jews stuck behind the Iron Curtain, and it transformed Rabbi Teitz. It tapped something in him that made him feel tremendous sympathy and empathy for those Jews and moved him to want to make a difference. When they got back, they urged everyone to travel to Russia. And he asked all the Jewish organizations to put Soviet Jewry on the top of their agenda. Now, very interesting, and we spoke about this a couple years ago, I presented on the Hillel Cook, Peter Bergson versus Stephen Wise, on American Jews and what they did to intervene in those years. And we talked about the debate in those years of the Holocaust, and then I gave a talk about the Soviet Jewry movement. And in both, there was debate about whether there should be protests and rallies. There was just this march the other day in New York, 25,000 people attended. And today that's a given. Today, who would oppose it and say, maybe you say it won't be useful, but nobody fears that it's going to be counterproductive. But in those days, Rabbi Teitz thought it would be counterproductive. As a person who made 22 trips behind the Iron Curtain and knew it well from the other side, he was worried that if too much attention was drawn and too much pressure was put to bear here through rallies and protests, it would be counterproductive, and that in fact, the Jews stuck behind the Iron Curtain would be the ones to pay a horrible price because of it. And therefore, he was one of, not the lone voice, but he was one of the few voices who was opposed to rallies. He decided instead to supply educational materials, religious items, and other support. Over the next decade and a half, he made 19 trips to Russia with his wife, one trip in 67 with his daughter, and one in 73, both with his wife and his daughter. He created an entity which calls Mohirim, which means quickly, and is an acronym for Mifal Hatzalas Yahadus Russia, Maher. He printed calendars, almanacs, booklets, and tzfar, and he created a religious manual and a sitter for Americans to bring to Russia to give out. Gordon Haas provided me a copy that he had of this exact sitter. You're looking at it. It's called the Sitter Kol Yisrael Chaverim. On the inside, Barichas Harav Pinchas Mordechai Teitz, Av Beis Din of Elizabeth. And he describes in English, For the past several years, since Soviet Russia opened its gates to foreign tourists, there's been a steadily increasing number of Americans and Canadian observant Jews visiting the Soviet Union. As a result, a great need has been created for a compact, all-embracing religious book to guide the North American tourist throughout his journey. This unique edition of Kol Yisrael Charedim was therefore established, especially designed for that purpose, to help the North American tourist who plans to visit Soviet Russia. And in it, he has the ability, through one book, to teach Torah, to teach Halacha. It has the Siddur, it has calendar, it has charts, it has pictures, it has Tehillim. It's really something which is phenomenal. Many copies were still were left there. No, that was right. You brought it in order to be able to teach. Correct. You brought it as if it was your own, and then you left it behind and gave them a religious manual to be able to learn and to practice with. He fought for refuseniks. He had a close relationship. I told you about this book, The Hours Late, or I would read to you from it, where there's a whole chapter, Friends from Abroad, about Rabbi Teitz. A venerable septuagenarian was an unlikely pioneer. But it describes the meetings with Rav Esses and how Rabbi Teitz didn't stop working for Russian Jewry. It's a beautiful chapter in here about it. For those who made it to the U.S., he helped them find apartments, jobs, schools, medical care. It wasn't just the work behind the Iron Curtain, but when he helped those who were able to get out, he helped them settle here. Elizabeth continued to grow with new buildings and expansions, and Erev was built out of concern that children wouldn't know there's a prohibition to carry. Elizabeth does something that nobody else does, others talk about, but because there was a resistance, Rabbi Teitz wasn't sure he wanted there to be an Erev, but was convinced that if they wanted young people and young families to be moving and comfortable in Elizabeth, they needed an Erev, so the compromise was reached. They would build an Erev, but they would announce once a year that it was down that Shabbos. So for one Shabbos a year, everyone would have to remind their children there's a prohibition to carry on Shabbos. Because otherwise, you grow up with an Erev, you don't even know there's such a prohibition. After the Yom Kippur War in 1973, the Teitz flew to Israel to visit with soldiers in Ramat Golan. That is a picture of Rabbi Teitz visiting with a soldier. He told members of Tzahal he had come to be a partner in the suffering fellow Jews. 1980-81, he grew tired of the Agudas HaRabbanim, their negative and hypercritical approach. We spoke about that in the Parsha Shir. That feels like it was days ago, but was just this morning. The Ephraim versus Manasseh. That Yaakov tells Yosef, you got to put an Ephraim before a Manasseh. Enough with the negativity and the criticism. Enough with the past. Let's build a bright future together. And that's what he tried to do. He aligned himself with Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. He opened a new rabbinic organization called the Merkaz HaRabbanim. It would focus on helping young rabbis find employment in bridging relationships. He also saw something he didn't like, which has only gotten worse, which is the emphasis on the Rosh Yeshiva away from the community Rav. And the notion that if you wanted real frumkeit, it was in the yeshiva. And the real leaders, Gedolim, were Rosh Yeshiva. And the community Rav was just a rabbi. He was just functional. He was just an employee. And he didn't like that. So he created this organization in order to stem that tide as well. It had support of Rav Shach and the Stipler from Israel, Rav Schneer Gaon from Lakewood, Rav Ruderman from Neir Yisrael, and others. But ultimately, at that advanced age, he ran out of energy. And he could not single-handedly run the organization. Others did not step up. And ultimately, it dissolved and fell apart. Rebbetzin Teitz passed away April 25, 1993. More than 1,000 men and women were at the funeral. October of 1995, Rabbi Teitz, who was in his 90s, was too weak to be in shul for an extended period. But there was an incredible scene that unfolded that last time that he was in shul. He came to shul for that yizkor. I heard the scene. I spoke to his grandson, Rabbi Blau, last night about several things that we're working on together and in anticipation of this talk. And he vividly described this scene to me himself because he was on the bima. It was yizkor. And he was going to be delivering that yizkor drasha. And when the door opened in the back, and Rabbi Teitz came in, an elderly, frail man at this point. It took him 10 minutes to be escorted to a seat in the front. And without coordination and without instruction, the entire JEC stood on their feet and silently waited for 10 minutes while he walked to his place. This last display of great kavod, of incredible respect from a community that he built and that he sacrificed for, that he loved and that he cherished. And the fact that in unison, without coordination, it was the spontaneous, intuitive reaction of all the people with such a fitting tribute to the man who had united them together, who had built and created that sense of community. 2 months later, December 26, 1995, the 4th of Teves, he passed away. I attended the Rebbetzin's Kvura. I was in my year in Israel, and I went to Keren B'Yavna with another grandson of the Teitzes, Akiva Resnick, who was a dear friend of mine, and I went with him to her kvura, her burial in Israel. And then the next year I was back, and I went to his funeral at the JEC in Elizabeth. I just want to give you for, I know the hour is late, but you'll bear with me for one moment. But I just want to show you, they produced, you could find this online on YouTube. But I'm not going to make you watch the whole thing. Where is the... you know what, I can't even figure out how to fast forward. If you find this online, you'll find this tribute to Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, and it has included in it segments of his speaking. It has his initial, his launch of the first broadcast of Dav HaShavua, his speaking. It has him on a couple of occasions celebrating the inauguration of some of these institutions and of their groundbreaking. And his passion, his oratory skill, his charisma. I'm just listening decades later over the internet, and I'm like, oh, we got to build that. We got to make that happen. That has to be done. And that's why people responded. A group of Holocaust survivors who became known as the Builders and who were successful responded to his leadership. They got behind him. They wanted to build. They loved the image, the picture that he painted, and the portrait of a brighter Jewish future, of a continuity against all odds. When Look magazine was cover story was the vanishing Orthodox Jew, Rabbi Teitz was saying, no, there's a bright future for Judaism. We're going to build it and we're going to model it. And it starts here in Elizabeth. So these are the takeaways from this talk. For me, what Rabbi Teitz means, as I say, having known him personally, for many of you, for all of us in America, what he did and what we should appreciate. First of all, how he blended together that he was rooted in Slobodka and Telz in Europe, but he adapted to the modern world. He spoke the modern language and he used the modern tools and he engaged modernity and he encouraged his community too as well. And he found that blend, that tension that we aspire to, which is to be rooted in Torah true tradition, to be true to halacha, true to Mesorah, true to where we come from, but be able to adapt it and blend it with the best of modernity and what this world has to offer. He was an extraordinary Talmud Chacham. And if you look at his correspondence or the fact that he edited and printed the Rugachev's works and encouraged and was largely responsible for the Meshech Chachma, he was in his own right an extraordinary Talmud Chacham. He was an activist. Russia, Agudas HaRabbanim, the Vat Hatzalah, traveling across America, recruiting to day schools. He was an activist. He was a pioneer. The Daf HaShavua. He was a Rav and community builder. Built an entire system of a whole community. Mikveh, Erev, Kashrus, Geiras, Gittin, you name it, single-handedly was running the entire community. Rabbi Wein said that he was in Chicago, and Rabbi Teitz came, and all the other Rabbanim were bemoaning what was lost, and Rabbi Teitz alone spoke about what they were going to build. And therefore, Rabbi Wein went to become a rabbi. He was a lawyer, a successful lawyer. But he became a rabbi. Rabbi Wein credited Rabbi Teitz because he said, all the other rabbanim he heard from the old world, they talked about what was and what was lost and what was gone. Only one rabbi came in and he said, what will be? What we're going to build? What we're going to create? The continuity we're going to have? And how deeply that inspired him. So when I reflect on Rabbi Teitz and his contribution to the American Orthodox scene, I think any one of these contributions would have been extraordinary. We think of people, they specialized in being an activist. This one specialized in being a Talmud Chacham. This one specialized in being a Rav. He did it all. He blended them all and was successful and seemed tireless in his efforts and succeeded so much at a time in which things that we take for granted were radical and were, if not impossible. He made the impossible possible. He built not only a beautiful community, at a time in which no one thought there could be Torah outside of New York. Elizabeth today is not so far outside of New York. But in those days, might as well have been on the other side of the world. To think you could build a vibrant Torah community, but he did. And from there, it has become a model through which our community still continues to learn from and to aspire to, as do other communities as well. His neshama, his yurtzeit was just last week. His neshama should continue to have an aliyah. Thank you very much.